Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 23. I'm here with Dr. Marcus Hellyer from SAA, and I'm Michael Shoebridge.
Hello, Michael.
So we've got a bit of a catch-up episode because we've skipped a little while. We're going to talk about tanks, missiles, Snorkus, the submarines, and the US election. So hopefully it all comes together, but it's pretty much what's been happening over the last few weeks.
Packed agenda, so let's get moving.
So, first of all, tanks. The Australian Army's announced that it's retired the tanks it has, the M1 Abrams.
Can I use my line?
Go ahead.
Tanks for the memories.
And unfortunately, while we're having those lovely, fond memories, there's been some very emotional stuff from various Army people about how much they've loved these M1 Abrams tanks. They're not getting their new tanks, the M1A2, until sometime late next year. So, have we got another capability gap here, Marcus?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, that we've retired the M1A1s and we're not getting any M1A2s until next year. So it brings to mind the helicopter gap between the MRH-90s being rapidly retired
and the Black Hawk
and the Black Hawks coming to replace them. So I do find it very strange that we have these capabilities that are meant to be absolutely vital and important, and yet we're quite happy to live with these quite lengthy capability gaps.
We've got no warning time, and multiple governments are saying if a war breaks out, you have to go with the capabilities you've got. But we're happy to live with over a year gap in our tank capability. I find that very strange. I think it's an indicator that defence hasn't really taken seriously that fact that there's no warning time anymore.
Well, look, all capability transitions are difficult. We've spoken about this before. The best you can hope to do is kind of maintain some capability during the transition, but you're probably always going to have some dip in capability. But it's kind of unusual that you simply give up completely and say, we're not going to have any at all.
Well, one thing that really is of interest to me, and I don't know the answer, and the fact I haven't heard the answer from government or defence bothers me, is what's happening.
Are you going to use the U word?
I am. What's happening with the M1A1 tanks that have been lovingly cared for and maintained and still have a service life left? Are they being put into storage as stockpiles for a time of crisis when we run out of these new tanks? Or are they being gifted to the Ukrainians to use, I don't know, somewhere like in their Kursk offensive because they don't have enough material, including armored vehicles? Or does the silence tell us there's another parallel with the helicopter debacle, which is that same team of chainsaw-wielding maniacs is busy cutting up the tanks and burying them like they did to the helicopters? I'd love to hear what's happening with the M1 tanks and why aren't they going to Ukraine?
So would I, but it's been absolute crickets. And like you, I think the last thing we want to do is simply chop them up and bury them, or whatever you do, you know, drop them on the Great Barrier Reef as a dive wreck or something. I hope that is not the case.
Well, here, silence is not golden. Silence is disturbing. So I'd love to hear from the government what's happening with those M1 tanks, M1A1 tanks.
The other sort of irony around this is that we said we needed more tanks. We had roughly 59. We're getting 75 new ones plus 50-something engineering vehicles. We needed more tanks because under the Plan Beersheba construct, every one of the three combat brigades needed its own tanks, which meant we needed more tanks. Well, now we're getting the more tanks, but we've moved on from the Plan Beersheba concept and we're going to consolidate all of the tanks back into one brigade. And so it's yet another example of defence's capability processes are so slow that the world has moved on before the capability is actually delivered.
But it does give us an opportunity to have another parallel with the Ukraine war, which is these tanks can now be parked at one big depot that can be captured in overhead imagery, very like all the imagery we see of various Russian armoured vehicles in various fields and depots. Mind you, the Russians have stockpiled and they're pulling all those out and using them in war.
When you say parked, by the way, I have heard rumours, and I will say the only rumours, that we won't actually be putting all of the new 75 tanks into service because we can't actually use that many in a single brigade. So they may be parked for a long time, some of these new tanks.
So the tanks are fitted for but not with a unit to use them.
With operators.
So. Okay. Well,
all right, moving on.
Away from the tanks, into missiles. So we've had a couple of test firings. We've had Naval Strike Missile from Kongsberg, a sponsor of the SAA website that's been successfully integrated onto the Anzac ships, the remaining Anzacs. Quick work. It's unfortunate that it's a retiring ship, but quick work to get a capable missile. And then there's been the test firing of the SM-6 from an air warfare destroyer, both very celebrated.
Well, the NSM, good missile. Not just saying that because Kongsberg's a sponsor, but good missile, very smart missile, designed for what we can call complex maritime terrain, archipelagic terrain. So very good match for Australia's operating environment. Very long overdue upgrade from the quite antiquated Harpoon missile, and is can go on to both our air warfare destroyers and the frigate. So good upgrade. Definitely give that a tick. But I would say, you know, it is only one small part of the equation. And one analogy I used is it's a bit like putting bigger guns on your battleships on the eve of Pearl Harbor. Probably a good thing to do, but it is not going to win the war for you by itself.
There are bigger changes in warfare, including warfare at sea, underway. And that probably brings us to the SM-6, because the SM-6 is a missile that the American Navy has used against the Houthis. I think they've said publicly they've used it to shoot down Houthi drones and missiles in the Red Sea. But there is a bit of a problem with that.
It is a $10 million problem, I would call it. So SM-6 costs about $6 million US a copy. So depending on the exchange rate, about 10 million Aussie. Ooh. So I am very concerned that this is extending the kind of challenge that the US Navy and other allied forces have encountered in the Red Sea. And that is, we are losing the value for money equation using multi-million dollar missiles to shoot down $1,000 drones. And this is simply taking that imbalance to the max. The other thing is I don't actually think we have any of these missiles. I can't find any record of the US government approving export of actual missiles. So we might have had one
so that to test fire, and we may have used the entire inventory of SM-6 missiles that the Australian Navy has.
Mm. And the other caveat is that...
So every missile that the Australian Navy has been used successfully.
in a test. Well, I mean, defence... If you're out there listening, feel free to correct us if we actually have some of these missiles in stock.
Well, there's on your point about, is this a cost-effective, smart way to do things? I put a piece up on the SAA website about this very disturbing report from the Commission on the US National Defense Strategy. It says around this very problem, the Joint Force routinely uses munitions that are significantly more expensive to produce than their targets, including in Operation Prosperity Guardian in the Red Sea against the Houthis, to maintain freedom of navigation. The Pentagon needs to develop additional options to keep the cost of munitions relative to the value of their intended targets in check. So to do that, the SM-6 would need to cost about $10,000 rather than $10 million. So that's only three orders
sure,
of magnitude.
I'm not sure how you shave off $5,990,000.
So I'm happy to celebrate the test firing, but I think there's a real problem in cost and numbers.
Well, the other problem is we only have three ships total that can use it. Air warfare destroyers, so the Hobart class. And we have three, so the good old 3-for-1 rule, we'll have one at sea. Plus, they're about to go in for a big extended upgrade that will allow them to actually use the full functionality of the SM-6, because we can't actually use it to its full abilities at the moment. So we'll have less than three ships that can use this missile.
Yeah, and this is the problem. On paper, fantastic capability. When you look at the practicalities, including the number of launch platforms and the number of missiles, it's not that impressive. Now, that naturally gets us on, talking about numbers and cost, to Snorkus, nuclear submarine. So since we last did a podcast, there's been the big Indian Ocean Naval Conference, and US Chief of Naval Operations was there, the head of the Royal Navy was there, and we had our Chief of Navy there. We also got a speech from Admiral Meade, the head of the submarine agency, and he said a really encouraging thing. All this stuff about the design of SSN AUKUS not being settled, that's all wrong, isn't it? What did he tell us?
Well, yes, Michael, our readers might recall we've been pondering this question of how mature is the design of SSN AUKUS, and we put up a piece on the SAA website.
And that piece says it's not mature because most of the main factors defining the design are not settled.
Well, by any standard kind of metric of project maturity, I mean, it is not mature.
But that's wrong now,
isn't it? But it's wrong because we have learned that it is live. That is not a paper design. It is live because it's already in the test tank. So when I heard that, when I heard Admiral Meade say it is live, it reminded me of our discussion recently about Igors and the assistance to these mad scientists. So I had this image of mad Professor Meade in the laboratory dungeon of his castle with Igor next to him.
With some lightning going on outside.
Some lightning going on and mad Professor Meade saying, it is time to animate the submarine. And Igor going, yes, master, yes, master.
The creature lives.
Yes. The lightning storm is coming. Prepare. Yes, master, yes, master. Throw the switch, Igor. Yes, master. And the big sparks of lightning. And then mad scientist Meade looking down going, it is alive. And, then Igor going, but master, the submarine is only 6 feet long. Yes, you idiot. It is merely a scale model. Take it to the test tank. Yes, master. But be very careful with it. This is no paper submarine. This is alive. Yes, master. Yes, master. So we're all wrong if we have concerns about the maturity of this, because it is mature, because it is live, not paper, and in the test tank.
Well, in fish terms, it's a fingerling, isn't it? It is alive, but it's just very little and it needs to grow. And so,
yes, master.
Forget Frankenstein. Paul Kelly is the guy to listen to here. From little things, big things grow.
Mm, it's got a lot of growing to go.
But I would,
by the way, just say that if they're so confident that what is in the test tank is a true scale model, then they can tell us how big this thing is. Again, crickets on that.
You're right. We could hear key things like what's the length, what's the beam, what's the diameter.
Mm.
That would start to tell us whether this thing is live or Admiral Meade is right. It's not a paper submarine because it's not yet a paper submarine.
It's not. And the other thing that's going on in Snorkers Land, there seems to be a bit of a counteroffensive coming from the supporters of it, the boosters.
Yeah.
Some may uncruelly say the grifters, but I'm not going to go there.
There's no carpetbaggers wanting to get rivers of cash out of boosting AUKUS.
And Lowy has published a couple of pieces recently, one by Labour MP Luke Gosling,
mm-hmm.
and one by defence analyst
Babbage.
Of some standing, mm-hmm. Professor Babbage, both defending it. Now, about the only thing they have in common, as far as I can tell, is that they think the opponents are all over the shop. They
Unfocused.
Can't get their story straight.
Yeah.
Now, one might say, well, there's so many risks around AUKUS, it's not surprising that people are raising different criticisms of AUKUS, but apparently they're all over the shop, they're missing the point.
What's the point according to Luke Gosling? Like, I think a big thing we needed to hear and we didn't hear at the Indian Ocean Conference is, what are these submarines for?
Well, interestingly, whatever they're for, they're not going to be doing it for some time. So Mr. Gosling, MP, says, by the time Australia operates its full fleet of nuclear-powered submarines, their first wartime deployment may be in circumstances completely unthinkable today. So that's not happening anytime soon. Now, here's a pain to say that these are about the defence of Australia and we are not going offshore to target some other country. And he says, that is why critics of AUKUS take the bait of foreign propagandists when they assume that it targets one specific country.
Mm.
Hmm.
These are agnostic submarines.
But then I read Professor Babbage's piece, and it is actually all about one specific country. And so his entire piece is about how these are about helping the US respond to Chinese threats to countries like Taiwan and other countries in the South China Sea. So it is about one specific country. So it's not the opponents of AUKUS that have taken the bait of the foreign propagandists. It's actually Professor Babbage,
okay,
the proponent.
Look, I think we now have clarity. The submarines are for local defence of Australia and not directed at any one country, particularly the only major military power with any credible capability to conduct major war in our region.
Well, we don't know, Michael, because the future is a very far-off place. So
yeah.
Who knows what the future will bring.
That's right. I mean, China might turn all those...
Sorry, do not use that foreign propagandist word.
Did
you say China?
I was about to say the Chinese might turn the People's Liberation Army, Navy and Air Force into some kind of peace corps. So that could well happen with all of their lethal offensive capability they're building at speed. Mr. Gosling could be right. Mr. Babbage, Professor Babbage could be right. The problem is they can't be right together.
No. And the other interesting thing in Mr. Gosling's piece is, yes, these things are about the defence of Australia and our northern approaches, but they're also, and this is a line we hear a lot, about protecting sea lanes of communication. That's why we're getting SSNs.
Mm.
But then I look at contemporary conflict, say, Red Sea.
Yeah.
The US Navy, and we've mentioned this before, the US Navy has actually said, we can't defeat the Houthis. We will have to negotiate a solution. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the US Navy has 50 SSNs.
Mm-hmm. And they'd like more.
And with 50 SSNs, they cannot keep one sea lane of communication open against an adversary I could not describe as a great power.
Well,
so please explain to me how SSNs keep sea lanes of communications open. I can understand how they can shut them down. They're good at sinking ships. Cool. But it's every time a proponent of the SSNs starts talking, it's like I hear Mahan or Corbett, these great previous generations of great power strategic thinkers saying it's all about sea lanes of communication. But I'm not sure how SSNs keep sea lanes of communication open. I would love to see good analysis of that. Again, world, if you're out there listening, please.
I think the problem is you don't see good analysis of attack submarines keeping sea lines open because since submarines have been around, they haven't done that. In fact, attack submarines are good at sinking ships. They're not good at helping them float. So the
according to Mr. Gosling, they're going to be escorting merchant ships coming to and from Australia.
Well, the U-boat war during World War II, I don't think was about the Germans protecting sea lanes. I think it was about them trying to interdict and paralyze them. And they did a really good job. And I don't remember Allied shipping convoys resisting U-boat attack by having submarines along with them. They were trying to destroy those submarines with aircraft and surface ships.
Mm.
So I don't see that case for attack submarines keeping sea lanes open.
I think off the top of my head, I think there is one case of a submarine sinking in another submarine. The other thing about Professor Babbage's piece is I have to say, for a piece of analysis, it is remarkably uncritical of statements out of governments and other senior decision makers. So, for example, on the maturity of Snorkers, he repeats Admiral Meade's 70% figure.
It's a pity he wrote his analysis before the Indian Ocean Conference, or he could have said it's alive.
That 70% number, as we have analysed, is essentially a meaningless number, but Professor Babbage uses that to confirm against the sceptics that Snorkus is mature and on track.
Well, the Babbage analysis fell into that trap. I remember learning economics at Sydney University years ago.
You can remember that long ago?
Yes, and he fell into that trap of the assumptions you make define the work you do. And I remember, I think it was Professor Grunewagen at Sydney University. He told this story to illustrate the problem of economists and assumptions. There's a busload of economists going round the Alps in Europe, and it falls off into a ravine. And the only person in the bus that's screaming is the bus driver. And all these eminent economists are sitting there quite happily. And just before the bus turns into a flaming ruin at the bottom of the ravine, the driver yells back at them, "We're all going to die. Why aren't you all screaming?" And then starts screaming. And one of the economists, seconds before death, says, "But demand is sufficient. Parachutes will appear from the ceiling." So analysis that just accepts all of these assumptions we hear from the Defense Department and the Submarine Agency is by nature going to say everything's fine.
Well, that does remind me of an actual story. I'm sure your anecdote there is true, but I'm not sure how we have any record of their final comments before they died in a fiery inferno. But be it from me to question the truth of your anecdotes, Michael, but I was actually there last year at a conference where a senior UK admiral essentially gave that kind of justification for why Snorkers is going to work, and that is they need to start construction by a specific date because they need to deliver submarines to replace the existing Astute class submarines. So that means it will happen.
Because they need it to happen.
And the design will be mature.
Right.
Because they need it by date X, everything will fall into place.
So demand is sufficient.
We might just point him perhaps to the MRH-90 or to the M1 and A1A2 saga to say things don't happen that way.
Well, the thing I take out of the lack of factual information from people like the Chief of Navy and the head of the Australian Submarine Agency, and then this very light-on, badly-founded analysis that's diametrically opposed from people like Luke Gosling and Professor Babbage, is the actual status of the program is uncertain, and the government is not sure how to make the case for AUKUS against an increasingly sceptical Australian public.
No, and I'm becoming more and more pessimistic about us ever actually having real data. So the kind of data that we get out of the Australian National Audit Office's annual major projects report on major projects, I'm not confident we're going to be seeing that kind of data on this entire enterprise. And Defence will simply say things like, well, we're not actually in contract with BAE to build submarines. That's a UK government contract. So we can't really give you any reporting against that. It's not our place to do that. So I think there are many get-out-of-jail cards here where Defence is not going to give us that kind of information, and they will be backed by the incumbent government of the day.
That's going to do, though, is continue this corrosion of public support for what's meant to be a decades-long national program. So that's the bigger problem there. Now, the last thing is US elections. So I think the last time we spoke about this was... It's ages ago. It's when Donald Trump was clipped on the ear. And that was a big event, except I can't even remember it. Can you remember if that happened?
This whole thing is amazing. I mean, we often say, when looking at Australian defence stuff, you can't make this stuff up. But what's going on in the US election? You can't make this stuff up. It's quite amazing. I mean, particularly the way that the Democratic campaign has been completely re-energised by the nomination of Vice President Kamala Harris. And Tim Walz, out of nowhere, who is this guy? But he seems to be winning the hearts and minds of quite a lot of Americans. There are some who will never
He's like the everyman, isn't he? And I've heard a bunch of people extol him because he's Mr. Ordinary from the Midwest.
Well, what I see Walz bringing to the campaign is not that he's going to bring a particular state with him or a particular minority or whatever. It is, for years and years and years now, the Republicans have been able to claim Middle America. You know, so if you are from the Midwest or the Great Plains, if you like hunting, if you like driving a pickup truck, if you like eating big greasy corn dogs at the state fair,
if you got a moose head on your wall,
you are naturally part of the Republican tribe. Mm. And even more than in Australia, I think in America, people vote their tribe.
Yeah.
And the Republicans have been able to claim Middle America as their tribe. And so you naturally, as part of that demographic, think, well, my natural political home is the Republican Party. And there is Walz as kind of living evidence that that's not true. You can be a hunter and come from the Midwest. You can be a farmer. You can be a soldier and you can vote Democrat.
And you can win a thumping vote as a governor of one of the Midwestern states. Yes, yes. I wonder if the reason Kamala Harris chose him was because she knew that crazy bear story was going to come out about RFK Jr. And she needed her own hunter, shooter, fisher to contest that.
Tell us the crazy bear story.
I'll give you the
Michael.
Short version. So the crazy bear story. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. got this story out first because he wanted to get ahead of the media because otherwise he feared he'd look silly. He was falconing up in the Hudson Valley.
Falconing
with some pals. And either on the way there or the way back, someone in a car in front of him hit and killed a baby, a young bear, an adolescent bear. And he thought the best thing to do would be to skin that bear. So he put the body of the bear. He was dead.
Okay.
He put the body of the bear in his car, finished his falconing. Then he was driving into New York. He realized he had a dinner engagement at a steakhouse. So he went to this steakhouse and he was going to take the bear back to his home because he wanted to skin the bear and maybe preserve it. I don't know. Then he realized he had to get to the airport. So he was out of time to get the bear back home. So his next great insight was there'd been a series of people killed killed in various bike accidents close to Central Park in New York. So what he thought was, I'll dump the dead body of the bear in Central Park with a bicycle. It will all be associated with the bicycle deaths and accidents, and that'll be the end of it. The problem is, that's about 10 years ago, and the story's coming out now. And this is his version to minimize the damage to his campaign. So all these people saying that Harris chose Waltz.
I'm really struggling to follow this story, but okay.
All these people that say that Harris chose Waltz to be a credible package against the Trump Vance machine, that's wrong. She's done it to give her an antidote to the incredible appeal of the bear for RFK Jr.
Yeah, okay.
Or not.
What I will say is that I have been moose hunting in Alaska, and I'm probably one of the very few people in Canberra who has actually field dressed a moose and skinned and gutted a moose. And let me tell you, it gets very medieval very quickly. But I guess it does qualify me to be vice president of the US, perhaps.
Well, Sarah Palin was the previous vice presidential candidate who, she said, I'm the only vice presidential candidate that has ever field dressed a moose. So you could have a claim.
I could be the second.
But now what's the big effect, I think? I think you're right to say the Democratic side of US politics, the Democratic Party is energized now. Trump's wondering why he chose Vance, because Vance is not really adding to his appeal. And all of the energy now has shifted to the Democratic Party. So it's a really tight election, but we've got ourselves a ball game.
We've got ourselves a ball game. Look, last time we spoke about the election, we were sort of pondering what would be the impact of the re-election of Donald Trump on Australia. Now it's probably worth having a think about what's the impact of Kamala Harris becoming president, and there's a lot of things to think about. But the first thing that really comes to me is that neither Kamala Harris nor Tim Walz are really Beltway blob
deep state
insiders when it comes to foreign policy. It's like neither of them has been Secretary of State, or neither of them has been the head of the CIA. Yeah, obviously Walz was a non-commissioned officer in the army, so he's interested in those things. But I would say they don't have deep foreign policy expertise or maybe even interests. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but one suspects that will lead them a bit to default to the blob, to keep running those sorts of things.
Continuity.
There will be continuity. I don't think there will be major change in American foreign policy. Now, you can say that's good, that's bad, but at least there will be certainty there if you are a US ally.
Well, and some of that is the natural focus of a domestic election where foreign policy doesn't play a big role.
No foreigners get a vote.
However, I think we can say that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are less affectionate towards Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un than Donald Trump, and probably more predictable in their choices.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's been quite a bit happening in the last
few
weeks.
Quite a lot happening, but
I just think it's great. You know, you brought a sort of Frankenstein monster into it. I think we've got a bear in there. We've got a moose hunt. So for all those hunters out there, I hope this podcast is doing the job.
Well, great. I have to go because it's bath time and I want to go and play with my scale model of SSN Orcus in the bath. But hopefully we'll be back less time between episodes for the next one. So hopefully we'll be back in a week and a half or so.
Yep. Well, just be careful with that scale model because you know
it's alive.
Thanks, Marcus.